We are all immensely relieved that this endless session is drawing to a close.
Lawmakers prepare to gavel out. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, June 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Senator Lisa Murkowski finds herself voting against icebreaker funding.
I am in a very difficult spot. I will be voting against your amendment.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
And by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Nearly 2 months after its regular deadline, the Alaska legislature is poised to gavel out. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports that both chambers have approved a $5 billion operating budget and agreed on a way to pay for the deficit.
There will be no government shutdown or an 11th-hour deal to avert one. If you're a glass-half-full type, you could even say the legislature brokered a compromise with a couple of weeks to spare. The big sticking point in negotiations was the cost of living increases that public employees had negotiated in their contracts. During the House floor session, Finance Co-Chair Mark Newman explained that the legislature would pay for the raises this year, but there were conditions.
Number one, that these are one-time increments. Two, that there be no cost of living pay raises beginning with collective bargaining agreements negotiated in 2015.
And the legislature was directing Governor Bill Walker to make $30 million in agency cuts to offset the raises. Newman, a Big Lake Republican, also explained that the final version of the operating budget restored some money for education, the ferry system, senior benefits, and public broadcasting. While a deal was struck, there was some grumbling from both sides. Senator Mike Dunleavy, a Mat-Su Republican, defended some of the more contentious reductions that had been made in his body, noting that cuts will need to be even deeper next year.
We're looking at a $4 billion deficit, and if people thought it was difficult this year, it's not going to be any easier next year. And some sacred cows that escaped a haircut this year, some of those sacred cows may actually be butchered coming into the next year.
Meanwhile, Democrats expressed disappointment that the legislature did not consider scaling back oil tax credit payments or accept federal money for Medicaid expansion. In both chambers, the minority was split on the budget for these reasons. But they all voted to tap the state's rainy day account. Senate Minority Leader Berta Gardner said the multi-billion dollar draw was necessary to cover the state's budget deficit and prevent the government from grinding to a halt.
My objections to the underlying budget are not strong enough to take us back to the brinksmanship. They're not strong enough to endanger the permanent fund dividend, which is a proposal that's been floated. And we remain committed to trying to protect the fund for future generations. Lastly, I don't want to add even another single day to this special session.
There was one area of unanimous agreement.
We are all immensely relieved that this endless session is drawing to a close.
According to the legislature's accounting staff, the cost of the extended and special sessions exceeded $500,000. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
As one of its final acts, the legislature is advancing the Alaska Safe Children's Act. After passing in the House during the regular session, the bill passed unanimously in the Senate today. The bill requires schools to provide age-appropriate education meant to prevent harm to children. The section known nationally as Aaron's Law teaches students about sexual abuse and lets them know there are resources if someone is hurting them. The second major component focuses on dating violence and is being called Bree's Law. It is named after Brianna Moore, who was killed last year. her boyfriend, is scheduled to be tried for the murder later this summer. Over the course of its review, the bill was changed substantially from the original and became a controversial vehicle for unrelated bills having to do with standardized testing and school contracts with Planned Parenthood. Those riders were ultimately removed, and the bill sponsors believe that the final version matches their original intent. The governor is expected to sign the bill, and the program will be implemented beginning in 2017. In Congress this morning, a U.S. senator proposed adding nearly $1 billion to a defense spending bill to acquire an icebreaker, and that senator was not from Alaska. Senator Lisa Murkowski is normally an ardent advocate for more icebreaking capacity, but she felt compelled to vote against the icebreaker amendment. APRN's Liz Ruskin explains why.
In the Senate Appropriations Committee, it was Senator Dick Durbin, an Illinois Democrat, who talked up the need for an icebreaker.
The amendment includes $940 million to accelerate a Coast Guard icebreaker. We all know the reality of climate change is having an impact on national security, and the Arctic is a contested region with China and Russia asserting their interest there. The U.S. is falling behind in its Arctic capabilities.
Durbin's amendment also would have funded other high-priority ships and aircraft by shifting money from a war fund to the regular budget of the Defense Department. Normally, Murkowski's on a mission to convince the Senate and all Americans that Arctic infrastructure is a national imperative, and icebreakers are at the top of her list. She acknowledged feeling torn.
I am in a very difficult spot. I will be voting against your amendment.
In fact, all Republicans on the Appropriations Committee voted against Durbin's amendment, and not necessarily because they oppose the priorities. The problem, Murkowski says, is the spending caps known as sequestration.
What, in effect, Senator Durbin's amendment does is bust the caps.
This is part of a larger fight in Congress over how to fund government for the next fiscal year. Republican leaders are trying to pass bills that stay under the sequestration caps. But a majority of the Appropriations Committee, including Murkowski, voted for a non-binding amendment calling the across-the-board cuts unreasonable. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Congressman Don Young's Subcommittee on Native Affairs took testimony today on a bill to reopen land allotment selections for Alaska Natives who served in the military during the Vietnam War. The right of Alaska Natives to acquire allotments of up to 160 acres comes from a 1906 law. The Native Claims Settlement Act ended that opportunity for most in 1971, but Native leaders have said for years that many Vietnam-era vets missed out because they were serving elsewhere when the application period closed. Young's been making that argument in Congress for years, too.
Well, I mean, how many times have I introduced this bill? I think five times, and passed it twice or some crazy thing.
In 1998, Congress passed a bill to reopen the selection period, giving certain Vietnam vets 18 months to apply. Young says in hindsight, that bill was too restrictive. It only covered those serving for 3 years of the war. Nelson Anungapuk, an Army vet and longtime Native leader, testified today in favor of another open period for vets, this time with more land to choose from.
Our research indicated that 49 of our veterans living in Southeast Alaska applied for Native allotments, and every one of those applications were denied, primarily because of the existence of the Tongass National Forest.
Ditto, Anungapuk says, for applicants in the Cook Inlet, Chugach, and Arctic Slope regions. Young's bill is sure to be controversial because it would allow selections within the state's two national forests and in wildlife refuges. The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to decide by the end of this month whether Affordable Care Act subsidies are legal in Alaska and 33 other states that use the Federal Health Insurance Exchange. More than 18,000 people in Alaska could lose subsidies if the court decides in favor of the plaintiffs in the King versus Burwell case. The plaintiffs argue the ACA only allows for subsidies in states that set up their own exchange. Alaska's insurance director, Lori Wing-Hyer, is paying close attention to the issue as she waits for a decision.
In the meantime, we continue to work on our contingency plan, refine our contingency plan, exploring all options and what will be the most feasible for the state, and we'll be ready to discuss it in greater detail once the opinion is released.
Winghire says Governor Bill Walker is committed to ensuring that Alaskans who are receiving subsidies won't lose them. The average subsidy in Alaska is more than $500 each month. Without the subsidies, the Kaiser Family Foundation estimates the cost of the premiums would spike by 500%. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the first team in an engineless boat race up the Inside Passage is getting ready to cross the finish line.
The first place team is going so fast that there might beat the banner that we mailed here. The first place team might be faster than UPS.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. The Alaska Marine Conservation Council reminds Alaskans to choose local, sustainably caught seafood this summer. More information at akmarine.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council.
A 21-year-old man is under arrest for allegedly vandalizing one of Kodiak's most historic buildings, the Holy Resurrection Russian Orthodox Cathedral, and many of its contents. According to the Kodiak Police Department, Archimedes Garcia was arrested around 8 o'clock last night as he was exiting the church. Garcia is charged with burglary and criminal mischief. Father Innocent Dresdo, the dean of the Holy Resurrection Church, says many holy items were damaged.
From the perspective of the church, he knew exactly which things were holiest, and those were the things that were in absolute disarray.
He said the most holy items have been removed from the church to an undisclosed location and are being re-blessed. Father Innocent said Garcia broke several windows and desecrated items behind the nave. Father Innocent said that even though the church has been damaged, services will go on as planned. If you've run out of isolated wilderness to explore in Alaska, there's good news. Flights from Anchorage to the remote interior regions of Russia are about to resume. As KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports, annual passenger service from a Russian air carrier have steadily grown, even as geopolitical tensions rise.
In July, Yakutia Airlines will enter its fourth year of offering weekly passenger flights from Alaska to the Kamchatka Peninsula, or for the more committed traveler, all the way to Yakutsk, further into the interior of the Russian Far East. Mark Dudley directs marketing and logistics for Yakutia in North America and says the biggest chunk of their expanding customer base is sportsmen.
50% of the travelers last year were fly fishermen and hunters.
Families visiting relatives and tourists make up most of the remaining customers. While overall passenger numbers are up, Yakutia has fewer scheduled flights than years past to better fill out planes. Dudley has worked with the tourism group Visit Anchorage to entice more Russians to come to Alaska, but sanctions stemming from international tensions over the crisis in Ukraine have largely foiled those marketing efforts.
The crash of the ruble, losing 40% of its value, has happened just during the same period that we've been building up to over the last few years to really start receiving Russian tourists. So it was just kind of a bad timing, you could say.
That's not the only financial issue. Ticket prices can pack some serious sticker shock. The cheapest fare to Kamchatka costs a little more than $1,000, but is part of a promotional deal with a 16-day minimum stay. Round-trip tickets further on to Yakutsk can surpass $4,000. Dudley says the remote, isolated wilderness that draws adventure seekers also makes it difficult to achieve an economy of scale that would make for cheaper tickets.
Kamchatka is like Alaska was about 50 years ago. It's a region that was always sort of intentionally kept secret and isolated, and it's only in the last decade and a half or so that they've started promoting it.
Though carriers have provided regular service between Alaska and Russia off and on since the 70s, Dudley says the options petered out in the 2000s, and Yakutia is trying to fill that missing link. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The drop in oil prices has been bad news for the state budget, but good news for some Alaskans at the pump. But the gas price has been slow to drop in some Bristol Bay communities, especially Dillingham. KDLG has been hearing from a lot of people unhappy about the gas prices, as Matt Martin reports.
For example, take this gentleman who called into Open Line last Friday.
Here we are June first week, and we're still paying top dollar. Hope we don't get put the screws to us all summer here with the high gas price. Okay, that's all I got.
Those sentiments were echoed by others on Open Line and calls here to the station. Gas in downtown Dillingham has gone down a bit. On Wednesday, it was selling for $6.15 at downtown pumps, and that's down from about $6.33 a few weeks ago. Dillingham Delta Western manager Ken Ricewig says the warm winter we just came out of has had a lot to do with why prices haven't gone down further yet.
Because there was no snow and warm winter, we didn't sell as much fuel as we planned for. So we have fuel left over.
The fuel distributors did purchase much cheaper fuel this year, but until the holdover fuel from the winter is gone, the prices are likely to hold where they're at. But Ricewig says as more fuel is used and more deliveries come in, the price at the pump may drop.
Whatever price fuel comes in, we adjust our prices based on what's in the tank.
KDLG heard the same explanation from Vitus Fuels. It seems reasonable, but that doesn't mean it sits well with customers at the pump. While filling up his car Wednesday, Lawrence Sifsoff says he isn't holding out much hope that the prices will drop anytime soon.
Because why could they go down now when they're keeping them this high this far?
On Wednesday, I spoke with Stellings Automotive, who appeared to have the cheapest fuel in town at $6.10 a gallon. John Stelling said he very much expects to break the $6 barrier sometime this summer. Elsewhere in Bristol Bay, that's already happened. Upriver, Kilignic is paying $5.75. Naknek's bustling summer crowds are filling up for $5.45. And Togiak, the lowest, at $5.33 a gallon. How smaller communities, especially those further away from delivery hubs, pay less at the pump than others prompts plenty of discussion among many of us. But as one person at the pump Wednesday told me, there are some mysteries in life he chooses not to explore, and the price of fuel in rural Alaska is one of them. In Dillingham, I'm Matt Martin.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the Promise Tuition Grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
A federal agency will conduct a study to determine the danger of drinking groundwater contaminated by the industrial solvent sulfalane in the North Pole area. The research was sought by the state of Alaska as it tries to set a cleanup level for wells tainted by sulfalane from spills at a local oil refinery. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the new study will delay a determination on what constitutes safe water.
There's a lot riding on the cleanup standard. It determines what's entailed in addressing sulfalane groundwater contamination stemming from historic spills at the North Pole Refinery, most recently operated by Flint Hills Resources. Little is known about health impacts of consuming sulfalane-tainted water, and Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation Spill Prevention and Response Director Kristen Ryan says a federal agency has agreed to undertake a 2-year study.
This is basically a response to Flint Hills' request that we establish a cleanup level, and we have decided it's best to wait until additional data is available from the National Toxicology Program, a federal agency that does studies on emerging contaminants to determine their toxicity.
Flint Hills challenged a very conservative 14 parts per billion preliminary cleanup level. The state promised a response by the end of 2014, and Flint Hills spokesman Jeff Cook says the company is disappointed with DEC's decision to delay. He cites findings of a group of toxicologists the DEC assembled last year.
Those
studies indicated 362 parts per billion would be a safe level. In fact, research consistently points to the need for Alaskans to set its groundwater cleanup standard at 362 parts per billion.
There's been no laboratory research on long-term impacts of drinking sulfalane-tainted water. The DEC's Ryan says the federal study will employ animal testing.
The NTP will be using rats as the species, giving the rats a low dose of sulfalane over a long period of time.
About 1,500 people living on North Pole area properties where wells have tested positive for sulfalane contamination have been provided alternative water sources by Flint Hills. The company stopped operating the refinery last year, citing costs related to the sulfalane issue as one of the reasons. Flint Hills, former refinery owner Williams, and the state are embroiled in legal wrangling over responsibility for the contamination. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The number of wolves on Prince of Wales Island and nearby islands has dropped dramatically, according to a draft report from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. A state official says that decline is something to watch carefully, but he's not concerned yet about the viability of wolves in that area. Conservationists, though, are alarmed and say that number could be too low to maintain genetic health among remaining wolves. KRBD's Layla Carey has more.
In 2013, the estimated population of wolves in Game Management Unit 2 was 221 animals. A similar study conducted just 1 year later shows that number dropped to an estimated 89. Ryan Scott is the Southeast Region Supervisor for Alaska Department of Fish and Game's Wildlife Conservation Division. He stressed that those numbers are estimates based on a small study area on the Big Island.
DNA collected from wolf hair that's captured in passive hair traps where they roll on it and we collect the hair and use the follicles to collect the genetic information.
From that information, state biologists determine how many wolves are in the study area and then use that to estimate the number in the entire game management unit. Scott says it's an imprecise tool for such a large area. Prince of Wales Island alone is slightly larger than the state of Delaware.
We know the conditions are different. We know that the number of wolves are different in various places, but we do it because by regulation we have to set a harvest guideline based on a false population estimate.
The estimate of 89 wolves is the midpoint of a range. Scott says the population could be as low as 50 or as high as 159. Despite the lack of precision in the methodology, he says the study does show a clear drop.
A decline is real. It's the magnitude of that decline that I think we have to be really careful with. And it's going to take additional data collection and additional field work to identify the trend and what the trend is.
State biologists have been studying wolf populations on Prince of Wales for 3 years. The first year's information was not useful, Scott says, because scientists weren't able to collect enough data. That means there's only 2 years' worth to consider so far. Scott isn't overly concerned about the long-term viability of wolves in Game Management Unit 2, and despite the study's lower population estimate, he anticipates there will be a trapping season this coming winter. By regulation, the state can allow a total take of up to 20% of the estimated population, which in this case would be no more than 18 wolves.
That number is not set at this point. It's something that we are discussing and will be discussing not only internally, but it's important to have conversations with the trappers and with the communities and subsistence users, the Forest Service. So there's, while we know that the harvest guideline will be reduced based on regulation, to identify what that number is going to be, there's a lot of road to travel there yet.
Larry Edwards is with the Sitka-based Greenpeace office, and he is worried about Prince of Wales Island wolves. He points out that the wolf population study took place last fall before the winter trapping season.
The quota for that was 25 wolves. Actually, 29 were taken. So the number now is surely lower than what was reported in this briefing paper.
Edward says the genetic health of the remaining wolves needs to be considered when determining the population's future viability. He gives an example of a group of wolves on an isolated island in the Midwest, Lake Superior. That group had low numbers for many years, and people thought it was stable.
There's recent reports and science that have come out on that population now has crashed. There's only 3 wolves left there, and those wolves are in very poor health because of inbreeding. So once you get to a small population, you need to be concerned about inbreeding.
Edward says his group will review the official Alaska Department of Fish and Game study once it's released, but based on information available so far, he says Greenpeace likely will ask for an emergency closure of wolf trapping in Game Management Unit 2.
And that would involve both Fish and Game and the Federal Subsistence Board.
Subsistence hunting is managed separately by the federal government, but often in cooperation with state agencies. Conservation groups say logging and activity related to logging, such as building roads, has led to the decline of wolves on Prince of Wales Island, partly because more roads provide easier access for hunting and trapping. Edward says information from the state's wolf population study likely will be used in future challenges to old-growth logging on Prince of Wales Island. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
Race to Alaska organizer Jack Beatty is in Ketchikan preparing the final line, the finish line for the inaugural 750-mile engineless boat race through the Inside Passage, and he better be quick about it.
The first place team is going so fast that there might beat the banner that we mailed here. The first place team might be faster than UPS.
The finish line will be at the entrance to Thomas Basin. The leading team, Elsie Pittock, which is 100 miles ahead of the second place boat, is expected to arrive in Ketchikan as early as midnight tonight. Beatty says the 25-foot trimaran has a 3-man crew of experienced sailors who say during this race they have faced the worst seas they have ever been in.
40 knots of wind on the nose, 5 knots of currents behind them, so the seas were confused and steep and torturous.
Broken masts, leaking hulls, and other calamities have caused many boats to drop out. 21 boats remain of the 29 that finished the qualifying leg from Port Townsend, Washington to Victoria, British Columbia. All the boats are tracked with a live satellite tracker. The Fish House in Thomas Basin will serve as the gathering place as teams finish through July 4th. Beatty says he's looking forward to reconnecting with participants as they arrive in Ketchikan.
Real people that I already kind of liked, and now they've had this incredible experience. Some of them good, some of them bad, usually a mix of the two. Just reconnecting with that and hearing how it was. I mean, it's been the experience of a lifetime.
There's a celebration scheduled for the winners on Monday at the Fish House in Ketchikan. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Jay Barrett in Kodiak, Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Matt Miller in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Layla Carey and Ruth Eddy in Ketchikan. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.